The oral histories collected from the front lines in Iraq will give later historians a more personal, a more rounded version of events that unfolded in the first months of the war. The interviews are first-hand accounts of what worked and what went wrong for the Marines, covering everything from the supply lines to communications. NPR's Jackie Northam picks up her story.
The Battle of An-Nasiriyah in the first few days of the war was a pivotal point for the Marines. On March 23rd, dozens of Marines on the outskirts of the city came under friendly fire from a U.S. Air Force plane. At the same time, another Marine unit was moving through the heart of the city in an urban area known to the Americans as Ambush Alley. Before long, the Marines came under heavy fire from snipers in the buildings and the alleyways. 2 weeks later, in an interview with one of the field historians, Corporal John Wenzel said he learned quickly about how the enemy was going to fight.
We'd have people with AK-47s walk out and shoot at us, then we'd have them walk into the building, drop off their AK-47, come back out, wave, smile, and pretend like they were civilians, and then we'd watch them walk around the corner and real casually and just give somebody a point.
Yeah.
And then an RPG would round the corner and know exactly where we were, so and that's when we started going from picking our targets real delicately to, you know, pretty much an open engagement for fire superiority.
Many Marines told the field historians they were surprised when Iraqi soldiers took off their uniforms and melted into the general population. Often they were replaced by the Fedayeen, fighters loyal to Saddam Hussein. Major General James Amos told a Marine interviewer how the Fedayeen sickened him because they used women and children as shields.
I approach this believing in my heart of hearts. I don't want to call it propaganda. I'll just say the intent of the senior leadership of our country and of the military to preserve as much of the Iraqi army as we could, believing that they would need those tanks and that ammunition and those forces to rebuild the Iraqi army. When the Saddam Fedayeen came down and they were picking off our Marines, they became, in my mind, cannibals. And my whole perspective on how we were going to fight this war changed. I decided that I was going to try to destroy every single piece of Iraqi military equipment. And I was going to personally kill every single Iraqi soldier that fought back.
Lieutenant Colonel Jim Chartier, commander of the 1st Tank Battalion, says the Iraqi military could have provided stiff opposition if its soldiers had opted to fight, because it used the terrain to its advantage. Chartier's views, recorded 7 weeks after the start of the war, display a grudging admiration for the enemy and what Chartier calls their excellent defensive positions.
I can remember crossing a plowed field down in Azubir. Just on a whim, I said, I'm going to take my tank, I'm going across this field to link up, I think, with Toes or something. And I felt guilty. Get this, I felt guilty going over a field because I said, some poor guy with his horse and his plow just followed all these rows here, and here I am charging it. And so here I'm feeling bad about damaging some civilians' occupation. And in the middle of that field, blended right in with those four rows, was like a W entrenchment. Perfect
location in which to hide a tank.
You couldn't see it from the road because all you look is a plowed field. And then I noticed another one, and I said, it's a good thing I went through. Maybe I'm going to go through every field now, regardless of what they have planted there.
The interviews conducted by the Marine field historians highlight challenges to supply and logistics units, and to a new unit employed for the first time with the Marines. The Forward Resuscitative Support System, or FRSS, is a small, self-contained mobile surgical unit. It's capable of doing multiple procedures while keeping up with the Marines. But if lessons are to be learned, Commander Miguel Cubano, the officer in charge of the FRSS, has a few ideas.
The absolute most important thing that needs to be changed is their communication. It's absolutely atrocious. And we were left in Barcelona with no communication. We requested Iridium phones, we requested other modes of communications, and we were not given any kind of communications.
At times, the FRSS also had to provide its own security. Despite that, Cubano told the Marine historian that his unit performed well as it moved around the country.
We took, obviously, many casualties, many wounded, some dead, but thank God, I mean, the numbers obviously were significantly more on the Iraqis than our own Marines. I wasn't expecting the rewards of taking care of somebody that potentially was shooting at you, and being able to detach all your feelings of hate or the anger or whatever, and I think that will stick with me.
When the Marines lost one of their own, it was imperative to get the remains to the morgue. About 300 Marines were attached to mortuary affairs, not all of them voluntarily. Warrant Officer Cheryl Eitz says it was a hard assignment for some of the Marines.
I know several of the younger Marines came and said that they were afraid to come into the tent the first time. That many of them, it was the first remain that they had ever seen. We had a few Marines who said, I don't think I can do this. And all of them, we asked them to try to come into the tent and be there and try to work through that.
But there were fewer casualties as the Marines closed in on Baghdad.
And I remember looking at it saying, oh, there she be. And my God, are we going to go in there?
Much of Colonel Chartier's hour-and-a-half oral history is devoted to recounting the capture of Baghdad, which he says was earlier and easier than he originally thought. But once there, Chartier says Marines had to deal with a new challenge, widespread looting.
When we first pulled in there, there were looters all over that building, and in these buildings right here. I rolled in and tried to get the looters out. They were pretty bold. So I mean, I'm in a tank, though. I mean, you think that would intimidate them. So I took my pistol out. I put a few rounds up in the top of the building here to say, hey, I'm pissed. I mean it, you know. And they just looked at me like they didn't care. And then I started taking some fire.
Now the oral histories, more than 1,600, filled with anecdotes, criticisms, and lessons learned, are being sifted through at the Marine Oral History Unit in Washington, D.C. Colonel Nicholas Reynolds will write the first installment for the history books. Reynolds says there's no shortage of information.
Way more data than we can use. I think this conflict is a watershed in that sense. In previous conflicts, even through Vietnam, you didn't have enough. You know, there'd always be a gap that needed to be filled. Now you got so much that you're getting to a point where you say, no more, thanks. I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to read these 500 things, and then I'm going to shut the door and say, you know, I can't process anymore.
The histories probably won't be found in your local bookshop. Instead, they'll be read by up-and-coming commanders who can use the information in battle planning in the future. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
And you can hear more of the Marines' oral histories of the Iraq War at our website, npr.org.